started. How's everyone doing?
Good.
Hot.
Yeah? Well, hot. Yeah. It's a little bit less. It seems okay in here, but
cooler than the heat we had in Oregon and Washington.
I heard it's been awful, huh?
107, 110.
Though you probably had air conditioning
in
some
north
of the cold. Oh, so this is cold. I suppose so. It's all about what you're comparing it to, I guess. Well, my name is Kata Schwain, and I'm supposed to say the title of this session for the sake of the recording, and now I can't remember what I titled it. Something about animal encounters.
I got it. Do you want it?
Oh, yeah.
My heart stirred for a bird.
Oh, my heart stirred for a bird. Well, that sounds much better. that's a session I'd go to. so that's the title of the session. I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. My specialty is creative writing, and poetry in particular. My husband is here as well. He's teaching sessions this upcoming week on bioethics, actually. So we're both here on teaching staff and very happy to be here. Let's see. Is there anything else I want to say by way of introduction? Well, I'll just say the two poems we're looking at today are by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who lived from 1844 to 1889, and Emily Dickinson, 1830 to 1886. Hopkins lived in England and Dickinson in the U.S., and some part of me wishes that they had known each other. I don't know. I think they would have gotten on quite well. But that's just in my own private poet drama head. And I'm going to have you guys start out today by doing a little bit of writing yourselves. Before anybody becomes deeply frightened by that, it's going to be something fairly quick and fairly painless, but my rule for doing any writing in a situation like this is if you feel the need to write something that has nothing to do with the small assignment that I give you and you want to write, this is really dumb, I don't know why we're doing any writing, or you want to make a grocery list for when you get home or whatever, please feel free to do that as well. But I'm hoping that by doing a little bit of writing at the beginning, that will help us in our understanding of these poems. So, for writing, we've got some tablets here that would provide their own sort of backing on which to write, two different sizes of paper and some books, hard books to write on, and lots of pens. So if we could sort of pass those out amongst people. And those of you upstairs, feel free to come down and get stuff if you want, or yes, you can grab for it if somebody wants to.
Here.
Tablets.
And there should be Bibles or things
like
that. Depends.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have a tablet.
And I can run up and get more of everything. Oh, there's an extra pen up there. All right, so here is your...
I need a book. Everybody got a
book. Oh, your book. He has a tablet writer.
Everybody good?
One more book.
All right. So here is your assignment, should you choose to accept it. I would like for you to describe, in a paragraph or so maybe, an animal encounter you have had. An encounter with an animal, okay? I would assume that almost all of you have now had an encounter, say, with a deer in the village at some point. How many of you had some encounter with a deer? You've run into one? Yeah, okay. Or if so you can feel free to just describe the last time you were walking up Chalet Hill and you ran into a deer. Or you can describe an animal encounter from previous in your life that previously happened in your life that was especially vivid or meaningful to you. And to make this less stressful, don't feel like it needs to be poetic or anything like that. You can, if it helps, you can think of how would I describe this if I was writing a letter to a friend. If I was writing a letter, what would I say about this encounter? Does that make sense? So take about 5 minutes. Describe your animal encounter. Or write a grocery list. And maybe just try to finish up whatever sentence you're working on. Would anybody be willing to share theirs? Great.
Surprise sighting. Iron Mountain backpack, hot, tired, weary. Break. Food, erring feet, noisy stream, resume walk uphill into headwind, still tired, not talking, lion crossed trail, did not see us or come near us. Who wants to lead this time?
Oh, wow. Okay, what kind of information did we get? Does that make sense? What kind of information was she revealing about this encounter?
Her tiredness, her condition, weariness.
Okay, so we learn a lot about what sort of state she was in when she encountered the animal, right? So a lot of the sort of literal details of both, we hear the hot, right? There's a sense of the literal sense of the environment, right? But also some details about also the speaker's state, right? The state that she was sort of in when this moment occurred, right? Great. Okay, will somebody else read theirs?
Yeah. Once when we were in Yosemite, a bear broke the glass in our van and got inside to eat our brownies. We knew everything should be inside the food locker, but we forgot the Tupperware with brownies. We shone the flashlight on the bear, and he jumped out and ran away. We felt sorry for the bear because bears that are campground nuisances sometimes are euthanized. It was also embarrassing because everyone came in the morning to take photos of our van with a broken window.
Okay, so what kind of details were included in this one that weren't included in the other?
More about the bear.
More about the bear? Okay, so more details, more of the literal details about the animal itself. What else?
More of the feelings.
Yes. The sort of emotional response to the encounter, how it made them feel that this had happened, right? Anybody else want to share?
I was playing a game of keep away with a ground squirrel at dinner. My wrist was the only thing between him and my pizza. I went both high and low, but when I had let my guard down for a moment to have a laugh with a friend, furry fellow snatched a tomato off of my slice with his tiny fingers. Game, ground squirrel.
Great, great. Okay, so
I apologize for assigning a gender to the ground squirrel.
That's all right. Okay, anything different about this one? This response.
So immediately in the past.
Immediately in the past. Okay, great, great. Yes, immediately done. Great. What else?
There's a metaphor of another realm of activity, the game.
Okay, great. So metaphor is introduced. Okay. How about when, well, let me just skip to this. Okay, so when people have encounters with animals, and a lot of times when they write about them afterwards, and we're going to try to sort of observe these things as we go through the poem, right? There's lots of sort of, I'm going to put up sort of categories of responses, right? One is sort of a literal explanation of what happened, being really as specific as possible about, you know, the animal crept out of the shadows, its mane or its paws were this color, this was going on, this was how the light came through the trees, right? As much as possible, just revealing the specific details of the event, okay? Another is a sort of emotional response, right, where like yesterday on the way back from Heart Lake, I was covered in black flies, and mostly I just had the emotional response of like, oh my God, get these off me, right? Like a lot of anger. That was my main emotional response to that animal encounter, was just straight up anger, right? So sometimes, depending on how the response goes, it can really raise emotions in us. Some less so than others, right? Another category of response is this one, the speaker's state, which I would even call sort of reflective, right? Which is when you're seeing the animal, but you're sort of seeing yourself, wherever you are in your life, in the animal in that moment, right? So I see this Jo wandering out today with her two twin fawns, and I'm immediately like, oh, babies. Right? Actually, that was my first response. And then my second response, whenever I see twin things, my sister's here, actually, and she has a twin brother. So whenever I see twin things, I'm always like, oh, twins. I have siblings who are twins. So that the animal is in some way a reflection of your internal state, right, when you meet the animal, okay? Another is sort of, and these we could sort of debate these categories or whatever, but another can be philosophical. So you see the animal and you start thinking about, what were we talking about yesterday? We were hiking. There are the beaver ponds and there's the trout. And is the trout? Was it placed there by other people? Like, are those streams loaded with that? Or are they naturally occurring? You know, so like the animal encounter raises some other issue or question or takes you on sort of an intellectual discourse or dialogue or something like that. Another category, I would say, is spiritual, where somehow you feel like the encounter that you've had takes you to some new spiritual realm. Does that kind of make sense? Does anybody want to offer other sort of categories? Yeah.
Yeah, like anthropomorphizing animals.
Yes.
Like when saying that you're playing, like you can't play a game with an animal because like animals,
right,
they're playing games. They want food or they have different agendas.
Yes, and sometimes, though, I think in yours it didn't. I think it was separate. It can go hand in hand with this one, right? Where you're seeing literally not just human characteristics, but like your own characteristics.
Or the emotional response, like thinking of babies.
Right. Oh, cute, right? Like, any other categories people want to offer? Yeah.
Native Americans passed on,
okay,
stories to teach their culture to their descendants, to show how the world was created in their way.
Yeah, so sort of mythic, like seeing mythic,
yeah,
sort of larger than life, which could be connected to the spiritual or could be different, because sometimes the spiritual is more kind of an individual thing, and this is connecting culturally to an entire other story. Yeah, that's great. Fabulous.
Then there's a cultural, you know, sacred animals to some cultures.
Great. Okay. We could probably come up with more, but this is great to get us started. So now I'm going to pass out these poems. We're going to start with Dickinson. We're going to go through the poem and talk about it, but I want you to be particularly on... Let me be able to get these going while I... I think we'll have close to enough, but some people may need to share.
Thank you.
So first, I want to preface both of these poems by saying that we could talk about both of them for hours and hours, because both of these poets, in my mind, are completely brilliant, and there's much to be sort of hashed out about these poems. So feel free, as we go through, to offer any insights that you're noticing. They don't have to be animal-related at all. And we'll ask questions sorting those things out. But also just know, you know, this isn't meant to be a full analysis of either of these poems. To sort of guide our attention, the two questions I'm sort of interested in returning to at the end, at least, is what are we learning about the animal from this poem? What do we learn about what it does or how it behaves? And what do we learn about the speaker by the way the speaker talks about the animal? Does that make sense? So if you can imagine, I think a lot of times when we write, we feel like, okay, so if you think of like the zoo analogy, right? When you're describing an animal encounter, it's like, oh, I'm the observer here in the zoo, and what I'm documenting is everything that's going on behind that glass that I'm like separated from, and it's all about what's out there. But really, if we turn things around, it's also about the observer on the other side of the glass. And so both of those sort of interpretations and lessons are there, right? It's never just about the animal. It's also about what we learn about the person telling the story about the animal. Does that kind of make sense? Okay. All right. Would anybody like to read about the bird coming down the walk? Anybody a big Dickinson fan? Yeah, great.
A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. And then hopped sideways to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious. I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home. Then ours divide the ocean, too silver for a scene, or boundless off banks of noon leap plashless as they swim.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, butterflies.
Butterflies, yeah. Well, we don't expect to see the butterflies there, I think. Great, thank you. Well, let's start at the beginning here. First line, a bird came down the walk. What do you think? Does this sound like it's going to be a very interesting animal encounter?
Not so much.
Not so much. Kind of seems a little bit boring. Mm-hmm. Oh, great, thanks. There's a bird coming down the walk. That's really exciting. what... What does our next line reveal to us? He did not know I saw.
She's spying on him.
She's spying on him, right? So I'm the observer that the bird isn't even noticing, right? I'm observing the bird in its natural habitat, right? But the eye, the introduction of the eye, all of a sudden we know that there's a speaker present. It's not like she's pretending that the bird's just existing off alone by itself, right? Yeah. Anybody else want to say anything about those first two lines?
Doesn't the science say that the observer influences the scene?
I think that's a great point, James.
Even though she says the bird didn't know I saw it, there's some influence that the viewer
has in terms of what the animal's going to do next, yeah. So what's the first thing this bird does?
Mutilates a worm.
Mutilates a worm, yeah! And the bird, if we can sort of divide here, so we have, he bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw, one thing, right? Mm-hmm. Then he drinks a dew from a convenient grass. Then he hops sidewise to the wall. Then he glances with rapid eyes. And then he stirs his velvet head, okay? So like five bird actions, okay? Let's just go through and try to characterize with an adjective or two how each of these gestures feels to you. Does that make sense? So when you say he bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw, what kind of act, how would you describe that kind of action?
It's having breakfast.
It's having breakfast? Okay, but do you, is it like, if she said, he delicately plucked a
quite brutal.
Bit of brutal. Okay, great. Brutal. Anybody else?
Gory.
Brutal, gory. Yep. Great. Crude. What?
Crude.
Crude.
Natural.
Natural. Interesting.
Angleworm is given a little bit of personality.
Humorous.
Yeah,
it's
a fellow.
It's not just a holy worm, but it's another creature. It's
yeah.
A real person.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you say?
Capital A.
Capital A, yeah.
Merciless.
Merciless.
Are there any animals that cook their food?
Humans.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Brutal, crude, natural, and merciless. Okay. How about, and then he drank a dew from a convenient grass.
Civilized.
Civilized.
Gentle.
Thirsty.
Civilized. Gentle.
Clever.
Clever. Thirsty, somebody said.
Yeah.
Genteel.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's the word.
Okay, let's see if I can spell it. T-E-E-L?
Yeah.
Okay.
Efficient in
Ooh.
Both cases.
The dew is not very big on the grass, so we
no.
spot it well.
I wonder if the grass sounds like glass.
That's
mm-hmm.
right. Yeah.
The what?
The grass sounds like glass.
Yes, it is. It's you almost have an image of sort of pinky raised drinking, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay. Next one. Then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass.
Polite.
He wanted to eat the beetle.
Oh, polite, yes.
He wasn't hungry anymore.
Sated.
Great.
Intelligent?
Yeah. Very kind of him to sort of give the path over for the beetle, right?
Well, like Sarah said, it's got the hard shell. That's why
it has the hard shell.
It would be a little harder to get out than the worm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's true. So just sort of, he knows when to go for the food and when to let it pass by.
Discriminating.
Discriminating.
You're satisfied.
Yes. Sated, satisfied, great. Anything else? All right, how about he glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around?
Distracted. Paranoid.
Yes!
Observant.
Impatient, got it. All right. Survival of the fittest. Okay, how about he stirred his velvet head?
Beautiful.
Sort of regal.
Regal,
yes.
Great. That one was because it's the sort of metaphorical moment, right? It's the more when the speaker's, I mean, even though all of these things are through the speaker, that's the moment where the speaker really comes in and is like, the eyes look like beads, so.
Was he listening for an enemy or something? Being alert to something that might harm him?
The speaker may have been found out. You might have noticed that he's being watched.
It could be the moment where the speaker is found out. Anybody else want to offer any adjectives for the stirred the velvet head?
Noble.
Great. Okay, so basically in 12 lines, we've gone from brutal to civilized and gentle, to polite and intelligent and discriminating, to paranoid and fretful, to beautiful, regal, and noble. So amongst all these adjectives, how would you characterize what the speaker is doing from any of these words over here? From these sort of categories we talked about. Does that make sense?
Very observant of the bird.
Observant of the bird, okay.
Of the changes.
Of the changes, so the literal details? Is that what you're suggesting?
Of what the bird is doing.
Of what the bird is doing. So pretty clearly we can see, okay, the bird's eating, he's drinking, he's hopping, right? Like, you know, if we needed to make this into a feature film or something like that, you know, we would have a way of knowing how to move the bird around. That's pretty clear.
But this is clearly not Audubon.
Okay. How do you know it's not Audubon?
Well, because there is an emotional, it's infused with emotion, even though it's not.
Okay. So there's a lot of emotion in it. Would you say we're getting the speaker's emotional response to it? What do you think?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah?
I think she's reacting in each instance. She's playing off of that. And
so embedded in these... is the speaker anthropomorphizing the bird, or do you feel like it's actually the speaker's emotions that are in each of these things?
Speaker's emotions.
Speaker's emotions?
Oh. Well, but if you look at the next...
Yes.
The next bit says...
Yes.
She goes from describing the bird as something that's sort of very almost brutish to something that's kind of human, but then says, unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home, then oars divide the ocean. So the bird becomes something more than human, something greater than human.
Yes.
Artifice.
And before we even get to that, one of the really interesting lines in this poem is, like one in danger, cautious. Because you can either read that as the bird or as the speaker, right? Mm-hmm. He's stirring his velvet head like one who's in danger and who's cautious, right? Which would fit with all we've learned before about the bird in this section, right? But it's in the stanza with, like one in danger, cautious, I offered him a crumb, right? Like I'm being cautious about the offering itself, right? And so right after this line takes place, which could be the speaker or the bird, right? We don't know which. Then, tell me your name.
Jesse.
Jesse, but this great observation that then we go into this whole other world of description, right? He unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home. Then oars divide the ocean. So now all of a sudden we have the sky and we have the ocean, right? Present, too silver for a seam. Or butterflies off banks of noon leap, flashless as they swim. What's going on in those last lines? What's happened?
I think when he unrolls his feathers,
he's stretching out his wings.
Rolling.
Right, which is this. So at some level, the bird's flying away, right? But what else is,
It also becomes epic.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Epic, and certainly all of these unroll, row, soft, home, right? There's a lot of these softening and beautiful and sort of gentleness entering the poem too, right?
The language has gone from that real pretty straightforward description.
Yes.
Some metaphor, something. Now we're totally in the wrong metaphor.
Yes. Right. So, and we have banks of noon and the butterflies are, and plash. A plash is a little splash. Plash is a little, the butterflies aren't splashing around. I mean, you know, the butterflies are in the sky, but they're not making splashes. But, I mean, suddenly the earth and heaven, right, and the metaphors about both have sort of collided and intertwined in some way. Yeah? Does that make sense? What do you think? Do you buy that?
I think it's deliberately
takes you into a non-world.
Yeah. Say more about that. Yeah.
The last lines, there is no such thing as banks of moon. So she's invented that.
Yeah.
And leaping plashtras as they swim. Of course, they don't swim.
Right.
We're talking about them in the air.
Yeah.
We're doing that. So all of that is another realm.
Okay.
Which is something which is beyond our expression.
So you could even say that there's some sort of spiritual transcendence that's happening here at the end. Would you buy that?
Yeah, she leaves the earth.
I mean, I mean, one could make a heaven-like argument almost, right, for this sort of, or no? What do you guys think?
In a way, you know, it makes this kind of odd. You know the story, but we were at the Shedd Aquarium once, and they had this big cylindrical aquarium, and one of the little girls we were with said. She pointed up to the fish that were swimming above her and said, look, Mommy, look at the pretty birdies. And so there's some,
is the same, yeah, that she's witnessing the sort of ocean in the heavens.
Yeah, that it's all.
Is she attempting to unify?
What do other people think?
Attempting to unify. I'm building on what you were saying.
Yeah, is this a unification of sort of heaven and earth?
Oh. Well, if you just unify these living forms,
mm-hmm.
She's conflated them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to go back to the like one in danger cautious and then ask myself, with what follows, is it the bird that flees danger, or is it, or if you read it as the speaker, what does the last stanza mean to the speaker? In order to try to figure out who's in danger there.
Uh-huh.
Is it the bird or the speaker?
Oh, like is this a sort of motive? We see him physically, the bird physically escaping, but is this a sort of escape for her as well in some way? Is that kind of what you're...
I don't know.
Escaping
don't
danger.
It seems like almost with her interaction that... it kind of allows the bird to leave. It's kind of like setting it free. Well, not reasoning it free, but maybe kind of lighting the spark for it to get on its journey home.
Interesting. So her sort of gesture of that permits it to kind of carry on and go to this different place where it needs to be.
Well, with the description of, like, he stirred his velvet head, there's obviously, she seems to be at that point to appreciate just how, what kind of a moment she's sort of in the midst of. And so now that she's taking, that's sort of like the first action that she's taking. So, you know, the first thing where she could either make an end or it could keep going. So, some caution.
Yeah.
But we haven't been told what kind of bird it is.
Okay.
And I was thinking a bird does swim because he can, the ducks and the geese, and they just go down.
That's true.
Splashlessly.
Yeah.
And they have heads of brilliant metallic green. And so we haven't even found out what kind of bird it is.
So there are some birds that operate in both of these worlds, too, that aren't just sky birds, but are water birds, and can make that sort of journey between the two.
Isn't it the butterflies that are supposed to be swimming?
Yeah, I think the butterflies are the ones that are literally swimming. But you're kind of commenting that the two zones that we're in are sort of occupied by birds. As well, it's not that birds are just air creatures. And
I think I sense a connection. I'd like you to tell me if it's right or wrong.
Oh, yeah. I can't promise to be able to do that.
In the beginning, she says that it didn't know I saw. But it seems to me when she says he stirred his velvet head, and it comes right after I thought that there might be a little connection there, that she presumes it has seen her, and that is when she offers him a crumb.
Oh, that's what instigates her sort of offering?
And that then has her connecting with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly think that that's the moment of connection. I think Jesse was suggesting that maybe that whole stanza where he's glancing with rapid eyes that hurried all around, that that might indeed, like you're saying, be the moment at which the bird spots her.
Well, I think it's the point that he stirs the head.
You think it's the head moment? I can't tell you whether it's right or wrong.
Because that provokes her response.
I think that's a great read.
Okay.
Okay. So what do we learn about the bird, and what do we learn about the speaker in this poem? Yes, Ingrid.
Something about the speaker.
Yeah.
This is a kind of poem that makes people hate poetry. Truly. You know, it's going sort of like a children's poem, kind of cheerfully along, saying the bird came down the walk, and he didn't know I saw him, and he bit an angleworm in half, and then he ate the fellow raw, and then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. It's all sort of cute, and isn't this
yeah.
I mean, in spite of having eaten the angleworm.
It's kind of brutal.
It's like a children's poem. And then later on we have, first of all, incomprehensible punctuation. There are no periods. There's wonder what in the world the word than in the last stanza, than. What's than, or is divide the ocean? And rolled his feathers and rode him softer.
It was there are more soft roads,
softer.
Yeah, it was a nicer ride
than
the oars.
Than
oars.
Yeah. Wouldn't you say dividing the ocean?
No, softer than oars divide. Softer than oars can divide the ocean. Sort of.
Anyhow, it becomes very sort of abstract and metaphysical. And so then everybody that you had with you in the first part, it seems like she's deliberately going, guess what? It's harder than that and more complicated. And
do you think she's trying to complicate it, though, or do you think it's a moment of sort of beauty that this moment...
Well, very different styles.
Of the two sections.
Yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. The first part of the poem is much more literal and grounded, and that last stanza takes us into more abstractions, and as you said, a totally different world.
Yeah.
It's a moment of epiphany.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But as we said in the beginning, it started off saying, oh, this is not going to be anything remarkable.
Right.
But
okay.
She's finding beauty and simplicity in saying, like, this happens all the time in nature, and I'm stuck up in my room and I don't get out to see the
world. And I think it is, I mean, one thing that I think is a great way to just look at this poem quickly is to compare that first line, a bird came down the walk, with the last line, the flashless as they swim, right? And that she's gone from that to that those two extremes in this moment, I think, is pretty cool. Yeah.
I'm looking at the amount of things that are capitalized. This is not a bird. But this is, it's like so many, it's things are personified, you know? It's not a walk. It seems like things are more important than just
she almost had, it's the typographical convention of like German, where almost every noun gets capitalized in older German.
Well, and I'm sure that there's many a dissertation written both on Emily Dickinson's use of capitalization and her use of the dash, because there's been a lot of talk. I mean, we could do a whole week of sessions probably on the dash or on the capitalization, but you're absolutely right to point that out. And certainly, it does affect one's reading when you come to something like that. And even like if the word cautious is capitalized and crumb, it's natural when you come to a capitalization for that thing to take on greater significance when we're reading in English.
Yeah, Maria. She's all up in her head. It ends with kind of a beautiful description of an aesthetic kind of moment, but she never describes the bird.
Yeah.
She never describes the color of it, the time of day, any of it. So when she's actually talking about a real experience that she's had, it's all about the action and the thoughts that she's applying to the bird. And then once she's back in her head again and it means so much more, then it becomes more visual. It's kind of...
Well, certainly, she's good, in terms of literal stuff, she's good with the actual actions of the bird.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not so good with, like... I mean, like the woman in the back said, too, we don't even find out what kind of bird this is, right? Like... It could be a lot of different birds. It remains sort of, in some ways, kind of this anonymous figure, even though we know the actions it's doing. So
doesn't the creative writing teacher get this poem and say, describe more, please?
Show me the bird, don't count me.
There is a great, I should bring this up sometime. Somebody did something that was like, Emily Dickinson goes to writing workshop, and it's one of her poems, and it's like, what is your use of the dash here? Why are you doing this? What, and exactly this kind of thing, like, please describe the bird further, and like, plashless, what is that? You know, like, so it's her whole thing totally marked up as it would be, you know, in the workshop now. Okay, one more comment, and then we'll do Hopkins really quick.
I'm interested in the crumb as like the turning point.
Okay.
That things are kind of literal for that, and say, here, have crumb. It turns out it's not about the food. It's not about needing anything to eat. It's about transcending all of that and getting out of this workaday. Have a crumb. Have a crumb, Emily.
Yeah.
You know.
So that it's this tiny, minuscule kind of offering.
Yeah, and a crumb is kind of what you think that a poor child has. I mean, and the bridge, a crumb. No.
Or maybe it's a communion poem.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who can say? Okay.
One thing on this is that I think I build on it, but she says that her people hate poetry. Is I think, you know, you go along, you're in school and you take English and you take literature and you think, oh, this is really interesting and I enjoy it. And then you get into Walt Whitman's poems and they mean all sorts of different things. I can remember in high school saying, where'd you get that? And I thought that was the stupidest thing I ever saw. And it was because we're taught these rules of how to punctuate. We're taught these rules of applying to it, and we are taught that this is the correct way to say something, and then this poem comes along, and it's just totally different, and you have to figure out, what did he mean? If he meant it, why didn't he say it?
Okay, I'm going to give you a poem that's going to tick you off even more.
Oh, dear.
And we don't have that much time, but I'm going to make a lot of people read this out loud. We're gonna read parts of it together because Gerard Manley Hopkins, woo! He is in a tough. I mean, Emily Dickinson looks like perfect meat in a box expectations compared to Gerard here. And here you'll be pleased to see we get the kind of bird. It's a windover. And I will say, so Gerard Manley Hopkins lived around the same time, and he was a very religious man. Obviously, the poem is, we got the epigraph there to Christ our Lord. And Hopkins, before we even start here, invented, there could be an argument about this, but invented something called sprung rhythm, where he just went ahead and put lots. Basically, we don't like it in the English language to have a lot of stressed syllables right next to each other. It makes us kind of uncomfortable. We like to have like a stressed syllable and then an unstressed syllable and then a stressed syllable and then an unstressed syllable, just like iambic pentameter, right? Like Shakespeare did a lot of iambic pentameter writing. That makes us feel kind of, it's closer to the nature of human speech. In his poems, he did a lot of like, let's just throw a lot of stressed syllables together in all at once. And it can be kind of crazy. So I'm going to read it, and then we're going to go back to some phrases and make you all read it, because you got to get this in your mouth, even if it makes you mad. Okay, and we don't have time to discuss all of it, which is, anyway, okay. So this is his bird encounter. I'm going to take a sip of water first. And rather than worried about analyzing this, I want you to just focus on the sounds and the experience of hearing it, and then we'll focus on the experience of saying it. I caught this morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple dawn-drawn falcon in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, oh, my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plow down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. All right, you ready for some of these? All right, I'm going to give you a line, you got to say it back to me. Dapple dawn drawn falcon.
Dapple dawn drawn falcon.
How about rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy.
Rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy.
All right, we're going to do the first line nine. Okay, I'll say it first, and then you say, brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle.
Brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle.
Nice. Okay, and then we gotta do fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion.
Fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion.
Can you feel how that's different in your mouth than other poetry, or no? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
It sounds like stream of consciousness.
Sounds like stream of consciousness.
It does.
Yeah, my consciousness doesn't sound that good.
I know, I wish my stream of consciousness writing sounded like that. Yeah, and Hawkins, too, as you probably notice here, also uses lots of words in ways that weren't the way they were even being used back then. So you sort of go back and kind of try to figure, sometimes you can sort of figure out what he means, but there's a lot of wishy-washiness about some of the words themselves. Okay, so obviously this poem has lots of layers, and because we are running out of time, I'm just going to sort of open it up for a couple minutes here of just anything you notice and want to toss out about this one. And then after like 2 minutes of that, I'm going to like return us and do a little bit of wrap up. So anybody, yeah.
Just thinking of the Dickinson poem, I think the opposite. You know, this one is all that poetic language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Musicality, alliteration, sprung rhythm, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the phrase that gets me is, ah, my dear.
Ah, my dear.
You know, and that's where it's like right down to just love,
yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And all that other stuff is all around it, but there's that one little phrase.
And who theoretically is the ah, my dear?
Well, it's to Christ our Lord.
So. Yeah. So this moment of real intimacy. Yeah, and as people want to make comments, if you feel like this the you're seeing any of these things in there, mention that too. Yeah. What else?
The way he uses the sound of language reminds you, it makes more sense for a poem about a bird. Like, birds are incredibly musical, so why shouldn't the poem also sound?
Great, so all these sounds.
Yeah, and I like that it's like so breathless too.
Yeah.
Like, it just keeps going and it really captures the sense of flying and soaring.
Yeah.
Both on a spiritual, like emotional level and like seeing it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this feeling of it running on and on. Right, and the, so not only does it capture that, but the breathlessness of his emotion,
mm-hmm.
in terms of witnessing this, right? Like, right? Like, this is really intense. Okay.
I think it's the surprise of Christ being a falcon, which is a predatory bird.
Okay.
And therefore his interpretation of Christ is present in this. And instead of fear,
mm-hmm.
it's admiration he brings
at
the end.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of emotions that he has in seeing this bird that get wrapped up in there. And one, please take this poem with you too. One moment in the poem that's really interesting to look at, and I'm sorry we don't have time to do this super carefully, but when brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle. And the word buckle has many different layers of meaning, right? The two most interesting probably are buckle as things coming together and being unified, and buckle as them collapsing under themselves, you know? And so in terms of the comparison to Christ also, is this a moment of unification, or is it the collapse that because the next line is, and the fire that breaks from thee then, right, as a result of this buckling. And with Christ also, there's this sense of unification and having to fall, having to be broken for that unification to sort of happen. Does that kind of make sense?
And also, just when you read it, that word buckle just breaks out and has such power because it doesn't fit the rhythm.
Yeah.
And so then when you, I heard it so much as then the collapse and then the building again. But it's interesting to look at the poem too, just visually, and realize that is, would be the point at which you would want to have a climax.
Yeah.
In that rhythm and in that length of the poem.
And it is a sonnet.
It's a sonnet.
Yeah. So, which is also, I mean, it's sort of amazing because it seems like he's all over the place, and yet at some level he's working in a very specific form here too.
Well, I found this more enjoyable.
You did?
I did, because of the fact that it got me into the poem and
it
gave me some sense to the whole thing.
You were ready to gash Gold Vermilion by the
end. Right.
Yeah.
What was really interesting is it's like he didn't have enough words to describe what he wanted to say, and so he was kind of making things up. And sometimes I do that in my writing.
Yeah.
I don't really know what word to put with it, so I put one down that sounds like it would fit. But the buckling is almost like the weight of the emotion and the words not being able to hold it all.
Yeah, great. So also, in addition to whatever Christ references are going on, himself in this sort of moment of descriptive kind of ecstasy and like so much weight of these words and trying to communicate it and figure it out. And, okay, so I mean, I regret every time that we don't have, I would love to talk about this poem for like the next 5 hours. I mean, I think Hopkins is just terrific. He's awesome and doesn't sometimes get as much credit. Sometimes he does, but so I would encourage everyone to take the poem with you and spend some more time with it. The last, we're like almost out of time. The last thing we were going to do was I was going to have you read your animal encounter to somebody else and to have them give you insight on what they see about you and who you are by reading this encounter with the animal, by hearing you talk about this aloud, right? So if I can use Jesse as an example, right? Like, Jesse's animal encounter was very humorous, right? And there was a sense of play and metaphor and a description of tiny claws and things like that, right? So there's something about who Jesse is when he comes, in terms of what he's choosing, right? Just as we talked about with Dickinson, and we didn't get to as much with Hopkins in terms of figuring out who the speaker is, based on the way they write about the animal. So if you want to, or you can do this as a sort of self-psychological diagnostic later tonight if you want to do some internal soul searching. What is the animal encounter that you wrote about today? What does it tell you about yourself? I'm sorry that we didn't have time to sort of get to that, but thanks for all your comments about these poems, and thank you for coming, and please feel free to take them with you. If you don't want them, you can put them up here. If you have extra, I'd like the tablets back, and maybe we can make a pile of books and extra paper and tablets so I can return them. And the pens, too, yes. But thank you for coming.
Thank you.